everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. We've got a big old show for you. We're about to get into a ton of different topics, much of it having a sort of legal bent. And so we thought, you know what we should do? We should get an expert, actually. And so that's what we did. And so we're very lucky to be joined on the show. I believe it's the first time as a co-host, Charles Coleman Jr. joins us right now. Charles, how's it going?
Hey, John, how you doing? Thanks for having me. Yes, this is my first time as a co-host. Super excited. Looking forward to today's show and glad to be the expert that you guys found.
Awesome. So we have spoken previously on the show, and I know people probably are familiar with you as well from the Young Turks, but people who might not know you, tell us a little bit about your background and your experience.
So I am by trade an attorney. I was a prosecutor in Brooklyn, New York for several years, where I worked in the gangs unit, investigations, a number of different trials for the city's most dangerous criminals. Where after that, I transitioned to the civil arena, and I currently function as a civil rights attorney. That is my space. I do obviously a lot of legal commentary on outlets like the Young Turks. I also do a fair amount of diversity, inclusion, and race equity work for different businesses, along with human resource solutions. So taking the conversation about disrupting systemic inequity on all sides and moving that forward in different arenas, that's my specialty.
Awesome. Well, I think we've got a good rundown for you, considering your specialty. We've got a few different things I'm really excited to learn from you on. And so we're gonna launch into that in just a minute. Before we do that though, thank you to everyone who is already watching, regardless of what platform you're on. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already, to make sure that we spread the progressive message. And as we go through this hour of news, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or anything like that for either myself or Charles, you can send us comments, tweets, super chats, all of that, and we'll respond as we go. But with that said, why don't we launch into what's gonna be an absolutely packed hour. The trial of Derek Chauvin has entered its fourth day, and we have some updates from this morning for you. But I did want to just catch up a little bit on what was going on yesterday. We had a tense, emotional day, as you can expect much of this trial is going to be, with some witnesses breaking down on the stand and some new revelations coming in the form of new body camera footage. And so I want to start off with one of the witnesses, Charles McMillian. Here is a bit of what happened yesterday.
Mr. McMillian, do you need a minute?
Oh my God.
You okay?
Yeah.
I know this is difficult. Can you just explain sort of what you're feeling in this moment?
I feel helpless.
It's just, I mean, it's difficult even to watch. I can't imagine what it must have been like to try to go through all of that. And so publicly, you know, obviously a witness to the event, multiple witnesses have expressed that they believe that George Floyd was in grave danger. And I mean, imagine feeling like you're watching that as it happens, and you, like, your mind is going back to other instances where the cops have done this and someone has died as a result. But there's you feel like there's nothing you can do. If you try to intervene, you could be beaten or possibly killed. You could certainly be held legally liable because the cops are gonna be protected even in the process of doing something that might result in someone's death. So Charles, yeah, my you know, heart really goes out to all of the people who have for a year been living with, I felt like what happened might end up happening, but there was nothing I could do about that. That's gotta be devastating.
You know, John, there is a lot to unpack here from the micro level of what we saw with that individual witness all the way to the macro level, because you just said something that I thought was important. You said, my heart goes out to everyone who has been experiencing holding on to those feelings of helplessness for the past year. That's the entirety of Black America. Mm-hmm. Like on a macro level, that is the entirety of Black America that you just described that has held on to that racial trauma that resulted from watching that, whether they were actually there in person or whether they were forced to watch that video because it popped up in their social media algorithms or because it was just something that people were talking about. And so it's really important beyond the X's and O's strategically of what we've seen from both sides of the attorneys, and we'll get into that in a moment. It's really important that our audience, particularly our audience that are non-Black, understand that that feeling of helplessness isn't just limited to that witness. It isn't just limited to Charles McMillan. It extends to all of us. It extends to the people on your jobs. It extends to the people in your communities, because that's something that we carry with us, right? If anything, one of the things that people should be coming to understand about this trial and what it's putting on display is that living in America without fear of the police is a privilege. And I want that to really sink in, because taxpaying citizens who have done nothing wrong, who have not committed any crime, when it comes to people who are sworn to protect and serve them, live in fear. And if they don't, that is a privilege. That is bearing really, really strong consideration when you talk about what's going on in this trial. And I think a lot of it was put on display on a macro level with respect to this particular witness. Now, as you drill down on a micro level, we have to think about where this gentleman is positioned. He's 61 years old, I believe, which means that he was born pretty much on the tail end of, you know, where civil rights in the traditional sense, those gains were made in America. And so for him to be as deeply and as closely connected with something like that, and to then witness that some 60 years later is extremely traumatizing from a racial standpoint. So it's not surprising to me that he broke down. And the last thing that I'll say is, yes, we have been exposed to violence by police against people of color, against Black people, against American citizens for a number of different years now in a number of different instances. But this is different, and I'll explain why. When the police or someone is shot, when the police shoot someone, that's instantaneous. It happens very quickly, it's over, and you see it. This was nearly 10 minutes of excruciating visual racial trauma, where you had to watch it and you were there and you were present and you heard the sounds and you smelt the air and you saw the sights. And at the same time that these things happened, there was nothing you could do about that. And imagining that and framing it that way, like, and giving all those things contextually to the discussion is why it paved the way to see what you saw happen on the witness stand. Like, that is where that came from on all levels.
And it being drawn out just makes it, it feels like what Chauvin was doing, it's like there's so many more opportunities to not continue to do the awful thing that you're doing that you never should have been doing. I mean, like, I don't actually believe that the person who she, like the Trump, I don't know if you remember this, but Trump a few months ago said it was a really disturbing interview with Laura Ingraham where he said the cops who shoot someone who's unarmed, they just choke, you know?
Yeah.
They're just in a high pressure situation, they choke. I don't believe that at all. I think that you pull the trigger in a second, but there's a lot of time of training and thinking about different groups and all of that that ties into it. It's easy to sort of just look at the last second. There was a lot of time where we could have intervened, but this one, like, we're watching the video where someone could have intervened, or one of the cops should have intervened, or Chauvin should have come to his senses. And yeah, so it's somehow more devastating because it's drawn out.
I think that that comment, actually, that line of thinking, that choke comment, he actually used that earlier than that. I want to say it was in 2016, after Terrence Crutcher, the gentleman in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, was shot on a road. There was a female officer, I cannot remember her name. He was by his car, he had his hands up. She was listening to, I believe it was her husband or someone else who was in a helicopter. And she shot, and he was on the campaign trail and he was asked about it. And he said, you know, maybe she choked or maybe, yeah. And you're absolutely right. I think that in an instance like this, it makes it even more devastating to understand that this was something that you could have approached in a number of different ways. You had backup, so
we need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Your ability to sort of handle the situation differently was evident in terms of not necessarily taking that course of action. If there was a situation where, for some reason, Mr. Floyd was resisting to an extent that required you to take that amount of force in order to get the situation under control, we might be having a different discussion. I don't think we would, but we might be. However, you had the assistance of additional officers. Mr. Floyd, as we saw after a point, and even initially, was not resisting to an extent that would require that level of force or action to be taken. So those conversations, quite frankly, in terms of someone choking or what have you, as far as I'm concerned, are non-factors. I think that when you start looking at, again, now the X's and O's, going back to the specifics of what we know now from the trial, we've seen body cam footage. We've seen the footage from inside the store before things happened. So now we have a much more complete picture of how these events unfolded. And with that, given that, there in my eyes, from a former prosecutor standpoint, from a civil rights attorney standpoint, and then from a common sense standpoint, is literally no excuse for Derek Chauvin to have handled that situation in the manner which he did. Yeah. That level of force simply was not necessary. And now I think the defense is really grasping for straws, and it's going to be interesting from a legal standpoint to see how they continue to try and poke holes in the prosecution's case.
Yeah, well, you know, you brought up the footage, so why don't we go to that? Yesterday, we did see some additional body camera footage in the Chauvin trial of Floyd initially being approached by the police. So let's take a look at that.
Oh. You see your hands.
He points the gun at him. Like he sees him and he thinks, this is a person that I should be terrified of. I should be terrified right now. And so everything else that happens has to be seen through that lens, that from the very beginning, he sees a terrified man and he thinks that person could kill me at any second. And so whatever I have to do to protect myself is probably justified. And it's Charles, it's so devastating to continually see the footage and know probably not gonna have any effect. Like even when you see the cops.
Right. So I think you hit the nail on the head, John, in terms of understanding where the conversation about this particular video starts. This officer had already drawn his weapon and was pointing at Mr. Floyd as though he were a suspect who posed an imminent lethal threat to him. In that moment, through those actions, what he had done was weaponize Mr. Floyd's blackness as a threat that justified him pulling his weapon. See, what people have to understand is standard police procedure is not to approach a vehicle with your gun drawn. That is not standard police procedure, despite what the Chauvin defense team is attempting to articulate and make us buy. The manner that this confrontation actually began was already in violation of standard police protocol. So once you started in that vein and going down that road, there's very little turning back, especially when it ends as badly as it did in the case of Mr. Floyd. So the fact that Chauvin believed that it was imperative for him to draw his weapon is already problematic. And then as you go through the footage, right, like you've already articulated that this was someone who was clearly in fear. He wasn't resisting. He wasn't attempting to disrespect the officer, not follow his orders. He was actually in a panic. He was moving around. He was like, I'm sorry. He was extremely recalcitrant. And then after he was instructed repeatedly to put his hands on the steering wheel, it's exactly what he did. Yeah. So this story or this narrative that George Floyd was somehow non-compliant with the orders of the police is just simply, it's just not true. It's a falsehood. And now that we've seen the video, there's little debate in terms of how that looks, in terms of what that is going to mean. So from a strategic standpoint, from an X's and O's standpoint, what the prosecution is doing bit by bit by bit is that they are laying the ground, the seeds rather, and they're planting seeds to fertilize the ground in order to be able to connect those dots as the case winds up as to why you cannot talk about this being police protocol, as to why you cannot say that, you know, Derek Chauvin acted in fear of his life, right? Like you're taking away all these arguments, and that's strategically what's happening with how the prosecution is positioning it, which is what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, or I would say as a complete non-expert, at the very least, he doesn't appear to be acting in any rational sense in fear of his life.
Right.
I don't doubt he's afraid. He grew up in America. He's been trained to be afraid of people who look like George Floyd his entire life. And as a cop, he's trained that, yeah, you should definitely be afraid. And anytime you're afraid, the most important thing is that you protect your life. And the biggest justification for lethal force is you just being afraid. And so when you combine that with an America that throughout Derek Chauvin's entire life, up to and including today and the future, has trained him to instinctively be afraid and suspicious and hateful towards people like George Floyd, that is a horrific equation. But the footage shows that while he might have been feeling that, there was no legitimate rational reason for it. It wouldn't be a justification for lethal violence even if it did exist, but it doesn't exist. There was no reason, he was being irrational to respond in the way that he was.
Yeah, one thing that I do want to point out that the prosecution, and I think those are all excellent points and things that, you know, from the psychology of someone being in this space is going to be a very, very significant value to jurors as they think about the case and as they analyze, you know, the mindset. Because a lot of what is going to determine whether Chauvin is convicted and what Chauvin is convicted of is going to be about mindset. There is very little question. While the defense has brought in this notion of drugs and, you know, other things being in Mr. Floyd's system, and you know, there was some conversation yesterday and there may be some today about, you know, drugs and where did they get the drugs and all of that and how that may have impacted what was going on. There's very little question that Chauvin's actions contributed, if not were entirely responsible for George Floyd's death. So there's not a question of who did it. Although the defense would like to bring that in, it's not likely going to be what phases the jury. What the jury is likely to wrestle most with is what was the mindset? Did he have the requisite intent required in order for us to convict him of this crime versus this crime, of murder versus manslaughter? And so everything that you just mentioned is very important in terms of helping them to understand that and establish that. One thing that I do want to point out for viewers that's particularly important that people may have missed is the prosecution's witness lineup has been extremely diverse. Mm-hmm. And that's important because they are inadvertently putting on a cross section of what America looks like. and what the community looks like. We've seen different genders. We've seen different age groups, generationally speaking. We've seen different races. And all of them have tied into, you know, this theme. And the reason that that matters is you have a diverse jury. You have a jury that is, you know, it seems to be very ethnically diverse. It seems to be generationally diverse. And because of that, you don't want to put on a witness lineup that is sort of a monolith, at least in terms of visually what you're seeing. You wouldn't want to put up a jury of, let's say, I mean, not a jury. You wouldn't want to put up a witness lineup of every black person in Minnesota who had a problem, because then at one point it might be easier for a juror to say, oh, well, what else are they going to say? So on and so forth. Now you've put up an extremely diverse set of witnesses that really reflects what America looks like. So that also takes away an excuse for a potential juror to sort of blame what they are hearing or the position or the attitudes that they are hearing from different jurors on racial solidarity or anything of the like. So I think that's also a very skillful touch that the prosecution has engaged in around this trial.
I think that's a great point, important to bear in mind. Many, many states have been putting forward bills to try to restrict voting rights as a result of what we saw in the general election and the special election in Georgia. Georgia has already successfully passed one to try to make voting more difficult in a number of different ways, some transparently cruel and needless ways, which we'll get into. They say that they're doing this because they want to fight voter fraud and protect election integrity, or at least they usually say that. Sometimes they're a little bit more honest about why they're actually doing this. And we have an example of this with the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, in an interview with WABE Radio, insisting that President Donald Trump's charges of voter fraud actually had nothing to do with their law. Quote, a lot of this bill is dealing with the mechanics of the election and has nothing to do with potential fraud or not. So that's interesting for a couple of different reasons. So it is dealing with the mechanics of elections, cutting back on mobile voting booths, on ballot drop-off boxes, literally stopping people from giving water to those waiting in line. So he is right, it's dealing with the mechanics of election, but they say they need to modify the mechanics of the elections because of fraud. So if they're not doing that, Charles, if he's admitting it's not about fraud, and this is a bill that's almost certainly gonna be challenged in court, now you have the governor who signed it saying fraud wasn't the reason for it, then what was the reason? And does that make it a little bit easier to potentially try to get this taken out in court?
Two questions, very different answers, very different conversations. To your first question, in terms of what was the reason, I'm going to be very curt about this and very straightforward. The reason is very simple. What we are talking about here is white nationalism. I'm not talking about white supremacy. I'm talking about white nationalism, and there's a difference, and I'll briefly break down what the difference is between the two. White supremacy is just what it sounds like. It is the notion that ethnically speaking, white people are superior to other ethnicities and other groups. That is not what is driving this conversation. White nationalism is the idea, from a political science perspective, this is me putting my political science hat on, is the idea that America is a country that is founded by and for white people, and that the services, the government, the processes of what make up America are only for that group, that constituency to avail themselves of. And so this notion of democracy and people being able to participate in democracy in the eyes of a white nationalist is a falsehood, because that's not for you. And so when you ask the question of what is driving this law, what's the reason for it, the simple answer is white nationalism, because in effect, what they saw with respect to voter turnout, particularly in the state of Georgia during the 2020 election, was they saw that there was a group of folks who had a ton of access to the democratic process, who they had deemed were not supposed to have access. Folks were not supposed to have this much access, because from a numerical standpoint, it's very clear what happened. The demographics of the state of Georgia have been changing rapidly over the past 20 years. There's been a significant influx of people who have decided to migrate down there from the north and from other different parts of the country as the cities within Georgia have continued to develop. And so there's no question that the people were there. It was just a matter of being able to galvanize them in a way that allowed them access to participate in the democracy and the system and the democratic system that they hadn't before. And that's what Stacey Abrams and a whole bunch of other organizers on the ground in Georgia were able to do. And so in response to that, I think it was Kemp or another state legislator, it may have been another state legislator in Georgia, who actually had the gall to say, well, Democrats like to say that elections have consequences, and you know, this is no exception to that rule. Elections do have consequences. And so
it's Kemp.
Kemp said that, right? And so when I hear that, I'm like, oh, you're really clear. The consequence of everybody here participating in this election that we don't want to participate is that we're gonna make sure that they can't participate in the future. And so when you ask what's driving this, it's absolutely white nationalism. And that's just very clear to see, because if it weren't, when you look at the increase in terms of voters and voter turnout, all of the statistics have not been tallied as of yet, but we are clear, in order for Georgia to have turned blue, we're clear where the increase came from. We're clear in terms of what counties were responsible for creating that boost in Georgia. So because of that, you know, it's like, well, you're mad because this group of folks were now participating in the process? What's democratic about that? As to your second question around the issue of whether this can be challenged in court, it really does require us to think about what, you know, from a legal standpoint, in terms of presenting a legal argument around it, it really does require us to ask the question, if not voter fraud, what is the reason? If that's not the reason, if the reason is not voter fraud, and you've said that it's not voter fraud, what is the reason, number one, to change the mechanics in the ways that you have elected to change the mechanics? That's number one, right? Like, what is not being able to give someone water or snacks who's been in line for voting, what is that going to do to quell the notion of voter fraud, right? Like, if we're not having a conversation about systemic disenfranchisement, then what exactly are we talking about if you're saying that the reason is not fraud? That's number one. Number two is, why now? This timing is dubious. It's at best specious, but if you take away the notion that this has nothing to do with fraud or the allegations that were levied by Donald Trump around the illegitimacy of this election and the results, then it really begs or raises the notion that they're going to have to come up with something from a legal perspective that justifies this being enacted. Now, the one thing that I'll say is, if that is the case, they have an uphill battle, because to my knowledge, we don't have widespread evidence of these things happening. We don't have widespread evidence of fraud being an issue where it would justify this sort of law. I think the challenge that is going to plague people who want to challenge this law is being able to make clear the ways in which this was specifically targeted from a racial standpoint, because of course, as you look at the law, it's racially neutral, which is what it needs to be, at least on its face, to pass muster. I think that they're going to have to do a lot of research to be able to make the connection between, you know, racial disparities that occurred in certain communities that will be disproportionately affected by this new legislation. But once they're able to do that, I think they have an absolute viable pathway to challenging the constitutionality of this legislation.
Yeah, they're clever enough in 2021 to make the actual bill racially neutral, but they also make it hinge on things that are not racially neutral. They look at baked in inequities and disparities and then manipulate those based on access to polls, ability to take time off to vote, the number of polls for the people there, so that's gonna help to determine the lines, access and how many people, what percentage of people have voting ID. They know, we have to do the research, I guess. They've done the research. They know that those things exist. So then they make their laws racially neutral, but rest on a foundation of baked in inequities. And your point about the timing is a perfect point. They passed this right after losing two special elections.
I mean, it was, you know, it's so obvious in as much as Like, you couldn't even wait to go change the rules. Like, you lost. You were a
slow. And why not wait? There's no other election right now. Right. Wait 6 months.
I mean, just it only, in my opinion, puts on display how nefarious these notions are, because you were such a sore loser. You were so angry. You were so emotionally scarred that your red state of Georgia had turned blue, that like literally within weeks of your loss, you couldn't even finish licking your wounds. You had to decide, how do I change the rules to make it unfair for me and my folks to reclaim what we believe is ours? Again, this is white nationalism at play. And I think really quickly, John, one point that you made about, and it's important that the audience is educated, right? Because folks who watch TYT may be in debates with folks who watch Fox News, and like, it's important that when folks have conversations, they're reasoned and they're informed. So a lot of people may not really understand what's the problem with voting ID. What's the problem with some of these restrictions that people are placing? And you made an allusion to systemic inequities that are baked into the system that make it more challenging for folks. And I think that it's really important that viewers understand, because of those systemic inequities, that makes it more challenging for folks in certain areas to be able to get ID. The types of IDs that are necessary may only be accessible in certain places, that if you don't have access to transportation, if you are unemployed and may not be able to afford that, or looking for work or have a job where you can't afford to take off to go get an ID, all of those things are hassles, right? Like, all of those things are impediments to participating in a democratic system, which our Constitution guarantees us as a fundamental right.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so it's not that it's supposed to be this challenging to participate in the system. And so when it is, your point about the fact that this reflects on the systemic inequities baked into the system and sort of uses those to take advantage of folks and put them in particular positions has to be understood, in order to understand why those arguments about, well, this is racially neutral, everybody has to have an ID, everybody has to do these things, is because it does not impact every community the same, right? Exactly. And so I think that's what people need to understand as they're having those conversations and thinking about why this legislation is so problematic.
Exactly. And look, I'm watching the chat. I see some people who either honestly don't understand those inequities or are just trolls. I don't know which. It's hard to tell if you're just casually watching the chat. But for instance, really fast, and we've got some other stuff I want to talk about. Saying you can use ID. Well, yeah, sure, everybody has ID. Okay, well then why in some states does your gun license count as an ID, but not like a student ID card? Why is that? Why are certain types of ID very carefully chosen that are clearly more likely to be possessed by conservatives the thing? Why is it that they fight back against Sunday voting when they know that certain communities are more likely to use organizing around churches to get people out to vote? Like, come on, like, you can't pretend to not get that they're very specifically trying to target things that from a mile away view is racially neutral, but in practice is anything but.
I mean, the simple question is this. If you don't have instances of widespread fraud that are verifiable, right? Which we do not. Mm-hmm. If you cannot provide instances of widespread fraud that are verifiable, then why are you so intent on making it more difficult for people to vote?
Yep.
If there were instances like widespread where a particular method of voting had been taken advantage of, like, I understand that there are instances where we have, in terms of voter purging or purging rolls, where we maybe had dead people vote or so on and so forth. I understand that those things have happened. And to that, I will say that no system is perfect, and that there are always going to be people who seek to take advantage of the system, and you should never make it easier for people to ballot stuff or make the election not have the integrity that it should. There's no argument there, right? Mm-hmm. But the instances that we have seen are not having such a widespread effect that would require these sweeping levels of modifications and regulations from a legislative perspective, right? Yep. If anything, these are adjustments that could be handled by your local elections commission to ensure that the integrity of elections were maintained. Nevertheless, if you don't have those things, why is it so important to make it so much more challenging for people to vote? You're fixing a problem that does not necessarily exist in the way that you are making it seem.
Yeah,
and totally. And I think, you know, the question there is again, why? Let's look at who it affects. Let's look at who it impacts, and then you have your answer.
Exactly. And along the way, you have some splaining to do because some of the components of this bill are like needlessly cruel. So we're going to turn now to a couple of examples of the media apparatus for the Republican Party attempting to defend the, in my view, indefensible. So in Georgia makes it not only more difficult to vote, but specifically targets things like people who hand out water to those waiting hours in the scalding sun to vote, making that illegal. It's hard to defend that, but Fox and Friends is going to try. Let's take a look.
The water argument is what cracks me up, though, because what line have you ever stood in? If you go to Yankee Stadium and you stand in line to get a ticket, do they serve you water? Do you care?
Just hot towels. That's all I get.
I have been voting for over 40 years.
I've never had water.
And I have never thought to myself, okay, I'm going to go vote today. Will they have snacks?
Right, absolutely.
I'm not worried about snacks.
I know.
No water.
Well, they certainly made it condescending, Charles. So the people who might have to wait 2 hours or 4 hours or 6 hours or 10 hours, as we have seen in multiple elections, and they're in that position by design. The polls have been taken out of areas to create long lines. Now, for people who are in incredibly hot conditions, they're just complaining because they want hot towels and they want snacks, Charles. What do you think?
I think that this is exactly the problem when you don't have proper contextual framing around narratives. I think that this is where media becomes dangerous. And I think that for as upsetting and condescending as this is very, very, very problematic and very troubling because people take these sort of half-baked narratives and they run with them. I live in New York. I've been to Shea Stadium. I've been to Yankee Stadium. Never have I waited in line in Shea Stadium to go into and get a ticket, as the anchor said, for hours. That hasn't happened, right? So by way of an analogy, that's just poor logic. Let's just start there. Like, that's just a bad analogy to start with, to say, yeah, you know, if I go to a baseball game, I don't get the water while I'm waiting. First of all, You don't wait hours to get into the stadium. And secondly, if you wanted water when you got inside, you could get water. It wouldn't be a problem.
There's like probably people selling water nearby.
And there's probably people selling water. And let's be clear, because I live in New York, I can talk about this. If you're outside Shea Stadium or Yankee Stadium, best believe there are young people who are out there with the entrepreneurial spirit on, selling water out of coolers to people who are in line, or people who are just walking up because they know that it's hot. Right? Yeah. Like, and that's not illegal. So terrible.
Well, can I throw in, you're 100% right, but I just want to throw in one additional thing because for all the reasons that you're laying out and will lay out, it's a bad argument, but it's also a bad argument for something that's not happening. Right. Doing all of this to say they expect water, they expect snacks is a bad argument to defend, like if the bill had taken away government funding for snacks and water. That's not what's happening here. They banned it. They made it illegal to give people water.
Or if the bill somehow mandated snacks and water be present.
Sure. Why aren't they making the case for why you should go to jail if you give someone a water bottle or a hot towel or snacks? They're not engaging with that very much, Charles.
I'm going to say something that, you know, people may find to be offensive, but it is what it is, John. These are three white people who were essentially laughing at the notion that black people in the South in rural places who may have been caused to wait in line were thirsty for water and couldn't get, and now they can't get it. And it's almost like boo-hoo, boo-hoo, boo-hoo. You have three white people who are on this panel. And this is a law that was passed in Georgia. We know that Georgia gets hot. From a cognitive place, it obviously evokes a lot of imagery that is reminiscent of civil rights, reminiscent of what we have seen for the struggle for equality on behalf of black Americans. And for them to take such a cavalier approach to this is only demonstrative of their extreme level of privilege and aloofness.
Yeah.
And that's just, you know, and that's just what it is, right? Like, I'm not, you know, and this, these are one of these conversations that we have to be honest about, the racial component that is involved here and the underpinnings of privilege that these people talk from with respect to their positioning in order to call a spade around what we're seeing in the media.
Sure. Sure. Now, there's a slightly different angle on this. In addition to the bill in Georgia stopping people from being able to hand out water and all that, we know that most of the components will result in longer lines, making it harder to vote, making so some people will drop out or not even sign up in future elections to vote. Now, is that an issue? Seems like if you want people to vote, it'd be an issue. But right-wing pundit Ben Shapiro doesn't agree, and he has an interesting analogy to make.
Jim Crow explicitly created a separate system of law for black Americans and treated them as inferior. There's nothing in the law like that. That's not only an overstatement, it's just an outright lie. But, says Jamel Hill, all of corporate America should resonate to the lie. The law imposes new voter identification requirements for absentee ballots. Well, clearly that's racist. I mean, you have to show that you are who you say you are when you vote absentee? If you can explain to me how that's racist, I'm willing to hear it. Anyone? Bueller? It limits the use of ballot drop boxes. Oh, you mean like ballot drop boxes where people could just stuff the ballot box or take ballots out of the ballot box? It hands state officials more power over local elections. Even before the legislation passed, many voters of color in Georgia faced hours-long queues at the polls. By the way, voter suppression doesn't involve long lines any more than long lines at Disneyland are ride suppression. You know what voter suppression is? Voter suppression is where you don't get to vote. Making those waits even more arduous, the new law bans giving food and water to people in line to vote. That's not even true. It bans giving any gift to people in line when they are within 150 feet of the polling place. You can bring water with you. There are people outside who can give you water. This is just not true.
Okay, so he is lying there, but also really fast. Marissa, I have asked you in the past to not raise the pitch of his voice artificially. I think it's messed up that you continue to do that. It's making him look ridiculous. So if you could stop that. Anyway, Charles, so his analogy to ride suppression at Disneyland, we should take it seriously because in a lot of high profile write-ups and things like the New York Times. Charles, he's been referred to as an intellectual gladiator. So I'm probably too dumb to understand the analogy, but what do you think about it?
I think that Ben Shapiro probably knows a lot more than about Disneyland than I do at my age. But given that, so I'm going to yield to him as the expert about Disneyland lines. But what I will say is that I think, you know, he is doing what he is doing in order to feed that machine. His logic is obviously misplaced and does not follow on a number of levels. And it lacks context and balance. I mean, at the end of the day, we talked about the fact that if you look at the law in a complete vacuum, of course, there are a lot of provisions that seem to be fine. I don't know that Ben Shapiro has actually ever seen or used a ballot box in order to talk about people being able to take votes out of them. I don't think he really understands how those work. But even still, what he is saying, again, raises the question of why. Right, like even if I accept all of the absurdities of what he's talking about, even if I give credence to every argument that he's made, my question is, why are you solving for a problem that you don't have evidence of existing? Like you're going through extensive measures to address an issue that we do not have concrete evidence of having been a problem. And so the question there is why? Like explain that, like explain why. And then if that's the case, why now? Right? Like did you just somehow think that all of a sudden we need to really shore up these potential security threats to our electoral process? Like now is the first time you thought of that? Really? Right? Yep. So because of all of these things, I can't take Ben Shapiro seriously. And then with Marissa raising his voice and speeding him up so that he actually sounds like Mickey Mouse, there's no way I can take him seriously. Like that's just not happening. So, you know.
Well, and
that's all I have to say on that one. So yeah, that's all I got, John. All I got on Ben Shapiro.
Now look, my last point on this is their audience, the Fox and Friends audience, the Ben Shapiro audience are not like analyzing his analogy. They like the idea of black people not voting as much as Ben Shapiro and Brian Kemp do. They're down for all of this. I would just point out though that if you are going to go up there and say, how dare those other people be bothered by long lines, I think we get to speculate about what the longest voting line is that they've ever waited in. Has Ben Shapiro ever waited longer than 32 minutes to vote? Kilmeade, Ainsley Earhart, have they ever waited 4 hours to vote? I don't think so. I never have. I voted in Connecticut, Texas, and California. I've never waited more than 30 minutes. And sometimes I just walk in and that's it.
I think, John, I think, you know, all jokes aside, we talk about context. And what you are saying from a practical standpoint is exactly what we are talking about in terms of how context plays out and why it matters. For people who are not clear about what John and I are talking about, let's make some things clear. There are voting sites and voting places within the state of Georgia that disproportionately had fewer polling stations either open or available, or voting machines available for the amount of population that these areas had. And this was known, and this was understood, right? And so that is going to make the lines longer. You have a denser, more densely populated area, and yet you have fewer voting machines, or you have just as many voting machines as an area that literally has a fraction of that. So from a conceptual place, it's important to remember that you cannot compare your experience as a voter when you just walk into a space and you're able to vote and you're in and out within 20 minutes as to another area that has significantly fewer resources allocated to them in terms of voting machines and voting booths and things of that nature, but has a population that is like twice as much as where you live, or three times as much as where you live. That is where we're talking about. So the idea that, oh my gosh, they have to wait in line. There were people who I know in the state of Georgia, and I have family who lives in Georgia, who literally waited hours, not 1 hour, not 2 hours, going on 3 hours to vote. A 30-second process, a minute and a half process, right? You get your ballot, you go in, you do your thing. This is a process that takes, you know, 2 minutes. If you have a sense of what you're doing and know what you're doing, but it's not an extensive process. And yet and still, there were people waiting in line for hours, right? Sure. Like, I think that's what people have to understand, that all voting sites are not created equal from a waiting standpoint. So it is indeed a function of privilege when people are laughing about the amount of time that people are waiting in line for stuff, because it matters and it makes a difference.
Yeah. Especially when, as you pointed out, it's almost universally a bunch of conservative white people laughing about people in Georgia having to wait in line. Wanted to give you a bit of an update on Pizzagate, the scandal rocking the nation right now, with Matt Gaetz apparently being investigated for possible sex trafficking. There are a few new details today, including that while, of course, Matt Gaetz would lose his House seat if he was convicted of a felony, there are currently no rules addressing lawmakers under investigation. It's a very slapdash sort of thing that depends on whether the party leadership wants to act right, basically. So for instance, Kevin McCarthy says that he's going to keep Gaetz on his committees, including the Judiciary Committee, which oversees the FBI and the DOJ, unless the allegations prove true. There's a bit of an issue there, which Ted Lieu pointed out, saying, dear GOP leader, you don't seem to get it. If it's true Representative Matt Gaetz engaged in sex trafficking, he needs to resign and be prosecuted. In the meantime, you can't have Gaetz sitting on the congressional committee that has oversight over the department that's investigating him. Now, in case you don't know the basics of the story though, he's been apparently Gaetz has known for months that he was under federal investigation over accusations that he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and paid her to travel with him. During that time, he's remained on both the House Armed Services Committee and on the Judiciary Committee. And by the way, we've learned now that the Justice Department has also been looking into whether Gaetz may have also been involved in relationships with other underage girls, as well as there are talks about investigations for a variety of different bits of corruption and things like that. Charles, in terms of what you've seen so far, and I understand there's a lot that we don't know about this, what do you think about what we've learned?
I think that for Gaetz to continue to sit on the Judiciary Committee as he's under investigation and he knows he's under investigation is the epitome of impropriety. I think that, you know, what I will say is that while on its face, this story does not contain an outright racial element, I think that what we are looking at is white male privilege. and it's being preserved by the GOP. Because the reality is that were Gates a woman, were Gates a person of color, were Gates a black man, that there would be calls for him to not only resign from the GOP, but there's absolutely no way that they would be okay with him remaining on a committee that oversaw the governmental entities that was responsible for investigating him on criminal charges of this nature. Like, it just wouldn't happen, right? And so the idea that he would knowingly do this and sit on the community, I mean, on that committee, it just demonstrates a level of unparalleled entitlement and privilege to this space. I think on a larger level, the GOP is continuing to fashion itself as a joke of a party. And this is where I hate to do sort of like partisan wrangling, but here's where, you know, I think that the GOP is continuing to paint itself into a corner in terms of who it wants to appeal to, who it wants to please, and what it wants to stand for. Because, you know, from a nonpartisan perspective, you have a member of your party was currently under investigation for sex trafficking a 17-year-old girl. And you are sort of allowing this person to function with all rights and privileges thereof. And yet you are also positioning yourselves as the party of family values, the party of morality, the party of conservative values, right? And so just from a sheer eye test, it's like, this is absurd. Like, and as you continue to delve into it and peel back the layers of sophistication and complexity around it, you see that this just doesn't pass muster in terms of who you say you are and versus who you are. And so if you're okay as a party with this level of an integrity gap continuing to be a part of your daily, you know, usual sort of MO, then understand that you're also making it readily apparent to the people who are on the outside who it is that you are courting and who it is that you're interested in maintaining and what you really stand for and what you're really about. And like, again, I hate to politicize something as terrible as human trafficking, because I don't think that it's a political issue. I don't think that it's a partisan issue. I think it's an issue of humanity. But the GOP, in terms of sort of turning the other cheek and looking the other way, you know, past Attorney General Barr was aware of this, like he was aware of the investigation, so much so that he sort of made it a point not to get too close to Gates when he was out with him in public. Like, it's just really disgusting. That's amazing. It's really disgusting. It's really amazing in the sense that you are putting yourself out as one thing, but there's absolutely no credibility to anything that you have.
Sure.
And that's been the case for the past 4 to 5 years, as we've seen. So the GOP has to continue to decide for itself, or maybe it already has decided, right? Maybe it's centrists, moderates, and leftists who have to actually understand that the decision has been made and it's been clear. This is where they are and this is where they're staying. Sure. Around what they're about and who they are, you know, in terms of the soul of the Republican Party.
I think you're 100% right. I'm glad that you mentioned the Barr stuff. I want to keep reminding people over and over that although they're all pitching this as some sort of like deep state thing, like Barr was in on this from the very beginning. Now you can say that it's backstabbing or it's different Trump loyalists fighting each other, but it wasn't Joe Biden that started the investigation. It wasn't AOC that launched this. It was Bill Barr. And so people need to bear that in mind. But there is one other aspect of this that I do want to cover. We don't know if Matt Gaetz did what he's being investigated for. We don't know now if he's going to end up losing his seat or ending up in jail. But I do know one thing. He is going to continue to be humiliated, largely due to his own ridiculous handling of this situation. And right now, he is being thrown under the bus by so many Republicans. So this guy who's like a star on the right, seeing him debased in this way is kind of hilarious. Like, as Charles was talking about earlier, Bill Barr like wanted to make sure he wouldn't be seen near Matt Gaetz. Bill Barr, like one of the ultimate Trump loyalists. But there's also the component of what's gonna happen to Matt Gaetz after he leaves. We had talked about this earlier in the week, but for weeks apparently, before news of the investigation broke, Matt Gaetz explored the possibility of a soft landing in right-wing media, reportedly including a potential job at Newsmax. And as the Daily Beast has learned, One America News Network and Fox News. Now, he apparently has said, this is Matt Gaetz, yes, I've had many conversations with many people about life after Congress. These conversations have been very general in nature and have never included me soliciting or receiving an offer of employment. There is not a single conservative television station I haven't had a passing conversation with about life after Congress. I have neither received nor solicited offers from any of them. But yes, I've talked to either executives, producers, or hosts at Newsmax, OAN, and Fox, Fox Business, Real America's Voice. I've literally never even heard of that one. And probably others I'm forgetting in this moment as I focus intently on refuting false accusations against me. First of all, let's note that him talking about life after Congress, he's 38. He's not Dianne Feinstein. That sort of is telegraphing a bit of trouble ahead. But anyway, the funny thing is that while he's right, he has never, or at least he's saying, I've never solicited or received an offer of employment. We can effectively confirm the second half of that because these different companies have been jumping out to say that they have no interest in him being on there. A Fox News media spokesperson said, quote, no one with any level of authority has had conversations with Matt Gaetz or for any of our platforms, and we have no interest in hiring him, which is just, I don't even like Matt Gaetz, but that hurts. An OAN insider told the Daily Beast, probably not, when asked if Gaetz has a chance to be hired by the network. This is OAN. They're barely actually on TV. Multiple Newsmax insiders also echoed similar doubts that Gaetz has any future as a cable news host, with one source pointedly declaring, highly doubt it, highly. Oh God, this is Newsmax, it's OAN. Oh, they make their on-screen graphics in Microsoft Paint and they don't want Matt Gaetz. Like that's gotta hurt. That's gotta hurt. They're hiring like people straight out of like high school Republican groups and stuff, but they don't want Matt Gaetz. Charles, what do you think?
I think that Matt Gaetz on this front continues to, in his white male privilege, demonstrate a level of disillusion about his surrounding reality that is on one hand laughable, but on the other hand gives great insight. By way of some very, very loose, I will concede that these are loose analogies. In my head, I was just thinking about a few folks. I was thinking about William Jefferson, the former congressman out of New Orleans who went down in a slew of controversy. I was thinking about the former mayor of New Orleans who, Ray Nagin, former mayor of New Orleans who went down in a slew of controversy. I was thinking about Marion Barry. Prior to him passing away, the former mayor, loved and cherished mayor of DC, who went down in a slew of controversy. And then I was thinking about Elliot Spitzer. And I was thinking about the fact that, like, after Elliot Spitzer had to resign as the governor of New York, he still was welcome on certain platforms and so on and so forth. And so now, previously, if anyone didn't know, all the politicians and elected officials that I named before Elliot Spitzer were black men, and Elliot Spitzer is a white man. And by way of comparison, I don't think that a single one of those individuals, meaning Bill Jefferson, Ray Nagin, Marion Barry, or what have you, I don't think a single one of those individuals really considered that after politics, they would have an opportunity to do progressive media. I just don't think that that was something that was even would even cross their minds. But yet here we have Gaetz, who's currently under investigation, right? And he really feels like, well, why wouldn't I be able to do TV? Like that's, those are the vibes that we're getting. And so you have to ask yourself, even as they are delusional, what gives you that level of entitlement? Like proverbially speaking, and I know that this is a daytime program, so I'm gonna try to say this as politely as I can. The balls on this guy. Like what would make you think that like that is your next step and option that you would be able to make that move? As laughable as it is, it's alarming.
Are you familiar with Joseph Ganim?
No, who's that?
So I'm from Bridgeport, Connecticut originally, and we had a mayor, Joseph Ganim. Joseph Ganim, like a lot of politicians in Bridgeport historically, was corrupt and he accepted money in exchange for blah, 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 or whatever. And he was caught actually. He went to federal prison for years. And then, as you were saying, he had the balls to run for mayor again. And the joke was on us because he won.
He was reelected
after federal prison.
Wow.
This is my hometown.
Wow.
He's white, by the way.
Shout out to Bridgeport.
Oh my God. Anyway, maybe he'll get a position. I don't know. Not there. Maybe he'll work for like Steven Crowder on YouTube or something. I don't know.
Nah, when Trump opens up his network, he'll get a job there.
That's true. That's true. He's a loyalist. Okay, really fast. I wanna just tee this up because I definitely want your thoughts on this. Very important topics. New York City has been making some big moves recently in changing the legality of a number of different things. The first that I want to talk about is qualified immunity, because New York, the city council has now voted to be the first state to end qualified immunity for the New York Police Department officers. It's not only the first, it would be targeting the largest police force in the US with some 36,000 officers. And so qualified immunity, which I think has been talked about a lot more in the last year or so popularly than in years past, that's a pretty big change. Although, as Mayor Bill de Blasio points out, it makes it easier if someone has a concern to bring a legal action, but it does not put the individual financial penalty on the officer. It puts on the department and the city. And that's what I was comfortable with, he says. So they still sort of have a version of protection. But Charles, what do you think about this change in New York? It seems pretty big.
I am proud to be a New Yorker because of this. I have been beating the drum around qualified immunity being a non-negotiable for Black people in America for a while now. I won't say how long, but as a former prosecutor, I can tell you that what I will say is that there's no culture in police and law enforcement without accountability. And now that, you know, we can have all the conversation that we want about the toxic nature of America's police force, but until we create some actual accountability within the culture, and this is what removing the barrier of qualified immunity does, we won't see things change. There's something very important about this that I want to point out to viewers though. As we look at the evolution of revamping criminal justice in America and what that looks like systemically, from a political standpoint, these things are going to be really, really interesting, because I suspect that New York is the first of what will be many cities that begin to remove qualified immunity. And then when you have, and you factor into the equation things like what my good friend Marilyn Mosby, State Attorney General in Maryland, in Baltimore, is doing out there, and experiments like that, right? Across the country, by and large, the top 10 cities that have the highest populations of Black people in America are democratically run. So what does that mean? It means that if we are looking at conditions that disproportionately affect Black people and certain communities, and these communities are all democratically run, from a partisan politics standpoint, number one, it opens the door for an opportunity that the GOP is missing terribly. And number two, it's putting Democrats on notice that the more people start looking around and paying attention, they're gonna have to shape up or ship out. Yeah. And it's going to set up a showdown between police unions, police, citizens, community, and crime. Now there's this sort of intersectional nexus of all of these different factors that we are going to see how this removal of qualified immunity plays out, because you can trust and believe that police and police unions are mad as hell right now. And you're gonna have to see what that plays out in terms of work slowdowns. Is crime gonna go up?
Yeah.
The experiment in Baltimore suggests that it won't, right? Like, you know, how's that going to affect the relationship between police and prosecutors? So there's a lot now that this sets the stage for. And I think that voters and viewers need to sort of really be paying attention within the weeds of how this plays out from a nuanced place in the political sphere, because it's going to have an impact.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that is fascinating. I do want to clarify one thing. I think I said first state to do this. It's the city. It's the first city to do this. So I apologize if I briefly misinformed anyone about that. So that is a big distinction. But as we pointed out, the NYPD is massive. So if it's going to be one city, that's a pretty big city for it to affect. You know, I'm Chicago and LA basically, or we'll see what happens. But anyway, Charles, that was awesome. Thank you so much. I've been watching throughout, and the reaction in the audience to you has been absolutely amazing. You know, I can't imagine anyone I would have rather had breaking down this particular list of topics. So thank you so much. Had a lot of fun.
Thank you, John. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me. Shout out to everybody who tuned in. I hope to be back. Please, you know, keep me in mind, and hopefully we can do this again. As Diddy said, we can do this every weekend. You know, awesome. That's a line from a Biggie Small song. But yeah, let's make this a regular thing. I'd love it.
Awesome. Sounds good. Talk to you soon. Have a good day.
All right, John. Take care.
Amazon is facing a number of challenges currently. Obviously, most substantively, it is the unionization drive going on in Alabama right now. But they've also owned gold themselves so many times on social media recently that there's clearly some other challenges too. And I can't think of anyone right now who's doing a better job of helping expose what Amazon is and how they're fighting against this unionization drive than one Kenneth Klippenstein, reporter for The Intercept and returning guest of the Damage Report. Ken, how's it going?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, feel like the pandemic's getting a little bit better maybe. And feeling a little bit of hope actually about what's going on with Amazon, especially, you know, like Bernie Sanders has been doing a great job of shedding light on that. People seem really fired up about it. You've gotten involved by offering yourself up as a source for leaks from current and former employees of Amazon. And you've been producing great work at The Intercept about what you've found out. So what are some of the highlights of what's been shared with you?
Yeah, so really the genesis of all of this, as much as I'd like to take credit as a reporter and, you know, brush my mantle and say, oh, I've done all this wonderful stuff. People are reaching out to me because they're angry at the company. And these are people inside of the company. And the folks I talk to, it's over, like, I've never seen anything like it. And what's driving a lot of the anger is that last week, their PR Twitter account responded to a number of high profile lawmakers, in particular, Representative Mark Pocan, as well as Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. In the case of Pocan, he was criticizing them for the worker conditions in their fulfillment centers, which there have been a number of reports alleging that the individual workers were having to urinate in bottles in order to meet these really bruising quotas, which was a story I heard again and again when I talked to folks that worked in these fulfillment centers. But the way that they responded to Pocan's, you know, pretty fair-minded critique, I thought, was to say, you don't really believe the urinating in bottles thing, do you? If that was true, no one would work here. And people inside the company who see this all the time were furious, not just that it happens, because as sad as it is, they've seen so much of it that they've just kind of, my impression has become inured to it, but that the company would misrepresent it like that. And what they told me, what I didn't know at first was two things. One is I thought, okay, this, you know, probably happens. There have been reports of it. It's probably not super frequent, I would guess, but we'll find out. What I found out was that it was really frequent, but I'll get to that in a second. The other thing I didn't know was if this was known to senior management, because oftentimes at the level of senior executives, they don't know what goes on at the ground level. They're completely out of touch. It's sort of like, yeah, it's kind of like the Lucille Bluth thing where it's like, how much could a banana cost? $10? That's kind of what a lot of executives think. So I thought, well, maybe they just didn't know because, you know, they're sitting in an air-conditioned room and they have no idea. But what I found based on primary source documents that were leaked to me from people inside the company, as well as countless verbal accounts, was that management knows about this and they address it frequently in meetings, and that they've also mentioned primary source documents a minute ago. They've memorialized this in formal policy directives. They've got on the books references to it and ways to punish it, that sort of thing. So they absolutely know that this is going on, not just that it's happening, but it happens all the time.
So that's interesting, because you said ways to punish it, and you're not talking about punishing lower managers for creating the conditions where workers have to urinate in bottles. You're talking about punishing the people for urinating in bottles.
Yeah, so what Amazon would say is that, oh, you know, if it happens, we don't approve of it. We tell people not to do it. And that's true that they tell people not to do it, but it's disingenuous, because when I talked to over a dozen people for this series of stories. What I heard again and again was there were never any concessions made to slow things down, even in the middle of an unprecedented pandemic that saw Amazon become a sort of shadow government where they're having to provide the logistical support for, you know, goods and services that people could no longer get by going to grocery stores and things anymore. There was no attempt to slow anything down. Full knowledge that not just that they were urinating in bottles, but what I found, and this had been reported before, is that they're defecating in bags just to meet these awful quotas that are impossible. I mean, I had so many people talk to me, they're like, I don't want to do this. This is dehumanizing and awful, but there's no way I can hit their quota and keep my job unless I do. So what they told me is that's tacit approval of their doing it, because they don't want to make any changes to anything.
Well, yeah, if they know about it and they're not doing anything to change it, then that it is approval. You can say that you want to punish it, but I don't understand what the alternative is. Just urinating where you stand. Don't use the bottle, maybe. You said that they address it in meetings. What does that mean? What are they addressing? Like, they clearly are not changing the system to stop that from having to happen.
Yeah, what folks told me verbally, the documents show that the punishments in place for these kind of things. But what people told me provided more color, because they don't always put everything in writing. What they said was that managers will tend to be like, look, don't get caught, or like, we don't want to see it. You know what I mean? So they're basically saying, when you do this stuff, hide it and throw the bottle out, clean these things out so that the public doesn't see it. And so someone like me doesn't end up finding out about it and reporting on it. So it's very disingenuous when they say they don't approve of it. It sounds to me like they don't approve of it's being found out or known. And you know, some of these internal documents talk about finding, you know, people defecating in bags multiple times in, you know, the past couple of weeks or several weeks. So this was something that was, you know, very frequent and not a marginal issue, as I initially suspected that it was when I first started reporting on it.
And, you know, at least in terms of the urinating in bottles, this had already been documented before the Amazon News Twitter account implied that believing in it was like believing in QAnon. That seems like a weird strategy, considering that the obvious response is going to be, here are the people saying that it happened. Their social media overall campaign seems kind of odd. And you've actually found out quite a bit about their social media front, right?
Right. So in a subsequent report, and I had all sorts of people reach out to me after the first story, and really a lot of people in the first story. I don't think people realize how many. I don't name everyone because I don't want people to get, you know, looked into and in trouble. But there were a lot of people involved in stuff. And so another thing that they gave me was some internal documents showing that they have a social media program codenamed Veritas. And what's interesting is they use it titled Amazon Confidential. I cover the national security agencies a lot. And it was kind of like, it feels like this cosplay of some sort of Jason Bourne movie or something, where they've got all these secret compartments to keep everything quiet. And it's funny because it's such a ludicrous program. And I talked to people in the comms department, they themselves thought this was crazy. And I'm saying to them, you know, if you guys think this is crazy, what are we doing? I mean, obviously there's going to be a selection bias for the type of people that are going to talk to you. But there are people that were seemed like they were generally true believers and said these kind of almost touchingly, you know, I would say naive things. I mean, they're very nice people. I don't want to denigrate them, but they'd be like, you know, we just want to provide service to the customer or something. And this isn't allowing us, this is you know, undercutting that goal. And so these were not, you know, like left-wing radicals by any means that were alleging some of these things. They were saying, yeah, we all thought this idea was crazy, but it was rammed through by senior management. My understanding is there's someone very high at the executive level that's actually bypassing the formal procedures they have for putting out not just these social media statements, but conducting this bot army that I was referring to a moment ago under project or under the program called Veritas, where they handpick employees to kind of do sassy clapbacks at elected officials. The documents mentioned Bernie Sanders like a dozen times, and it kind of instruct them on how to do these epic Twitter dunks, where they're supposed to just be windmill dunking on these figures. I mean, the example given again and again is Bernie Sanders, or I assume progressives. And not just that, but instructed on how to defend Jeff Bezos in this sort of you know, bold and kind of humorous way. They pick people for humor. And one of the most shocking things about these documents is it showed that these are not representative samples from within the company to give you a sense of what they're doing. This Twitter army of real human beings. These aren't bots. These are real humans that are putting out to tweet these things. There's a part in it where it says we might want to pick people that have not been here very long because they tend to be more enthusiastic. And so there were a lot of telling little quotes like that in it.
Yeah, you lose a bit of the shine goes away a bit as you defecate
the bag. The magic wears off. Yeah,
exactly. It's just hard to. I just can't keep the same motivation. Yeah. So I had seen some reporting. It might have been late last week that. Senior management, they might have even implied Jeff Bezos. I don't remember.
Yeah, that was the report. They said it came from Jeff Bezos.
Sure. Oh, I'm talking about was extremely frustrated about the way this was being discussed in public, that the response to people like Bernie Sanders wasn't strong enough, that might have been leading to some of the, like the you don't believe in the P thing. And that he's personally obviously very frustrated by the unionization drive. Do you know anything in terms of the leaks about their social media activity? Do you know anything about the way their tactics might change as we get closer to a resolution of the situation in Alabama?
Yeah, well, when we were first chatting off camera, you mentioned feeling more, you know, optimistic about things. One cause for optimism, I think, is that they're extremely scared about this union vote. And I don't think that the extent of the anxiety would exist if there wasn't a fear that this was a credible thing that could succeed and could happen. They're terrified, and that's why they're doing this. And you're right to call it an own goal. I mean, again, I'd like to take credit, but a lot of this is just people enraged by what they saw to be, you know, flatly false or just wildly unprofessional comments to these elected officials who are pretty popular. They're Bernie people inside of Amazon. They're Elizabeth Warren fans inside of Amazon. The reason they're deviating from, you know, their general strategy of just not commenting on these kind of things, I don't know firsthand, but I would guess something to do with it, that's the X factor here, the variable that's changed. And so I think they understand. I mean, there were cases where the NLRB, the National Labor Review Board, they found and alleged that there was retaliation against attempts to unionize in Chicago. And I think there's a lot of pressure talking to folks during the pandemic, because conditions are so bad, they desperately needed accommodations and concessions to be able to continue to work safely so they don't catch this horrible plague. And so all of this is putting enormous pressure on senior leadership to make these concessions, and to the extent that they're not able to, the workers are like, well, gosh, maybe we should just start a union. They're not listening to us. What else can we do?
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously they're afraid. And as Bernie Sanders has said, if it can happen there, then in theory it can start to happen elsewhere. So yeah, seems like they probably should be afraid. Now, you've already uncovered a lot. I know that you are, as always, available for more disclosures. I imagine there are things that we don't know about this whole thing. So if somebody is watching and they're a current or former employee, they know something they'd like to share, how can they do that?
I'm glad you said that, John. This is like part of the infomercial where it's like, you know, there's something I really want, and what could? Oh, I just happen to have it. Let me tell you guys about it. So, go on my Twitter. I've got my Signal. It encrypts your text messages. You can text me at 202-510-1268.
Nice, awesome. Looks professional there. Yeah, I like it. People definitely should. We need to know this, and the earlier that it can get out, the more chance it has.
Timing is critical.
Exactly. So everyone, if you have access to information, please do it. Ken is amazing at protecting sources, so you don't have to worry about that. And as always, Ken, we really appreciate both your work and you joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.